Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're going to call this a special episode only because I think we're probably going to spend a little bit more time on this podcast than we normally do. And as always, I'm joined by my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent charge from the LA field office and a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, retired director of the Northeast UPIC, and now our director here on our payment integrity team. So we want to talk about the takedown that occurred and the presser and the press releases and the press conference that occurred on Monday, June 30th, touting the largest roundup in the history of healthcare fraud investigations, 324 defendants charged in one way or another, civilly, criminally, whatever, what have you, and over $14 billion in identified false claims. Not all of it went out. And, you know, we put out a little primer saying that we were going to talk a lot more about this on this podcast. We're going to devote the podcast to that today. And first and foremost, there's been a lot of stuff on LinkedIn about this. A lot of back and forth about it. And, you know, the one thing I will say is that healthcare fraud is pervasive. It's been pervasive since the dawn of time. The OIG and IGs were created in 1978 to be watchdogs, and fraud has been pervasive since 1978. HHS OIG started in 1976, and fraud has been pervasive since then and probably before then. And we're just getting better at the investigations. But fraud, it permeates in every aspect of government. And in the healthcare space, it has been going on since the dawn of healthcare fraud. So, you know, it transcends political parties, it transcends political affiliations, and it really doesn't care about what party you're in. Fraud is fraud, and as you can see from these cases, the OIG and its partners will always continue to work to ferret out fraud, waste, and abuse one way or another. So, you know, where this all stems from, or a lot of where it stems from, is according to the press releases and according to the communication that's out there, is a lot of this stems from, in part, a breach that occurred in May of 2023 from Wisconsin Physicians Services, or what's known as WPS, which is a MAC. They're not actually located in Wisconsin, and they actually aren't a physician services. That's just their name at this point. In May of 2023, they had a breach from a hack, resulting in a compromise of over 1 million IDs. For those of you that have been around long enough, those IDs used to be known as HICS, health insurance claim numbers. They're now known as the MBI, Medicare Beneficiary Identifier. Previously, it was a challenge when there was an identity theft involving a HIC number, because the HIC was intrinsically connected to a Social Security number. In most cases, it was a Social Security number with a suffix of a letter or a letter number combination at the end to talk about whether or not you were the beneficiary, dependent, or dependent beneficiary. A few years ago, it switched over to what they call the MBI, which was essentially a randomly generated series of numbers, so that it wasn't tied to your Social Security number. The point being is that if there was a breach, that they could turn off that number. You know, and we talk about this a little bit here and there, and I've been on some projects involving some conceptual discussions of this, where, you know, the argument is that the MBI should be treated like a credit card. If that credit card gets breached, we can go onto an app on our phones, for the most part now, swipe it closed, and that, you know, that number gets shut down. And that has not really been the case here. There was a breach in May. In July, they notified CMS, and it wasn't until sometime in the fall of 2023 that they started to reissue those MBI numbers. You're talking about over a million numbers that had to have been reissued. And of course, the argument is, why aren't we treating the MBI like a credit card if there is a breach, and just shutting that number down immediately? You know, and the example is oftentimes when people get, you know, for example, if you had your wallet stolen, the last thing you think about is that your medical card or your medical ID is going to be part of that metric, but it clearly is. But as we know, most of the time that these numbers are taken or this information is stolen, these breaches, you know, occur, and we don't know about them for a long time. And then those IDs turn up on the dark web, and then we're off to the races. So of the $14 billion plus, we know that a little over 10 million or 11 million is directly attributable to an international organized crime group based out of Russia, Eastern Europe, Pakistan, and here in the U.S., and they were doing a bunch of things that are reminiscent of the previous $1 billion or $2 billion catheter fraud case. You know, again, we joke about the fact that how does an $8 catheter become $2 billion, particularly since one of the DME suppliers was a company that produced wigs for cancer patients that was doing about $50,000 or $60,000 in business, and all of a sudden it becomes a multi-million dollar business, you know, essentially overnight. You know, how does that happen? And I think in some regards, we're seeing in this case of the 324 defendants that were charged, a lot of them were in the DME space, the telefraud space. I've got some notes on that. I think 49 of the 325 were directly related to telefraud related cases out there, and a lot of that in the DME space. Most of the issues that are out there, and most of the people that were charged with fraud schemes that were already known to us. These are not mysteries. The telefraud, pharmacy fraud, drug diversion, 74 defendants alone that were healthcare professionals out of 324, 74 directly relating to opioid related cases, seven defendants directly related to skin grafts. This one's actually disgusting. Performing skin grafts on patients in hospice that were like literally at end of life, not some fraudulent hospice stuff, although there was other fraudulent hospice stuff going on. But, you know, patients that were at honestly the end of life is what it sounds like, getting skin grafts, you know, maybe weeks or a month or so away from death. And they're getting skin grafts done by doctors, you know, totally medically unnecessary. You know, these transnational schemes, the DME, are just out there. It's unbelievable. You can go online, you can read what each individual was charged with. Some people were charged by indictment. Some people were charged by complaint. Some people were charged with informations. So the big difference is an indictment is a showing of probable cause, more likely than not. Through the grand jury process, which requires having evidence presented to the grand jury seated in that district. Complaints are similar to an indictment. It's a showing of probable cause, but the agent puts together a complaint and swears that complaint in front of a judge. If the defendant still looks to fight that, you would still need to go for an indictment. And an information is a defendant is willing to plead guilty and they're waiving being indicted and they're agreeing to plead something. Oftentimes people charged with informations are people that have been approached and are either cooperating or are willing to just take the plea, and you typically get an information and a plea at the same time, and sometimes that comes with cooperation. And then there were a handful of civil settlements, and we'll never know the backstory about civil settlements. Some of them were for low dollar amounts, some of them were for higher dollar amounts, some of them were in districts that don't seem to do a lot of healthcare fraud cases, and so maybe it was just a tactical decision to treat it as a civil settlement because of potentially exclusion issues, which come out sometimes. If there were no patient harm issues, and sometimes an instance where the provider, if that provider is no longer able to practice because they get mandatorily excluded from the program, and there might be licensure action taken by the state, sometimes you'll see an instance where there's carve outs on exclusions, or they may decide to resolve the matter civilly to give the provider the ability to continue to practice and provide a need for care. A great example will be an instance if you have a provider, maybe they're a urologist and they're the only urologist in a 300-mile radius. And if you were to exclude them, there's no urology to be found and nobody gets their bladder cancer treated as a result of that, right? So oftentimes that may happen. So huge coordinated effort. Obviously, the thing to keep in mind is that 324 people were not all arrested on Monday morning at ODARK 30. That didn't happen. The case involving the transatlantic fraud of almost $11 billion, there was information about that reported in a couple of news sources the week before. So that had been dismantled the week before. And oftentimes these cases become kind of They're announcing it on June 30th, but it's been a rolling type of scenario because to do 324 defendants at one time presents a lot of challenges. And so, Wade, that's where we want to start is, if you're in the SIU and, there are 324 defendants and this one across Medicare, Medicaid, commercial payers, we saw that there's some auto accidents. There were some stage accidents, which you never see in the federal space. We also saw there were a handful of people that were part of the DC Metropolitan Transportation Authority that were getting false documents put in for workman's comp and the like. That DC case was reminiscent to me of the previous cases that I know that I worked on both here at Advise and when I was at the OIG involving New York City Transit Authority and New Jersey Transit. Very similar types of scenarios. But the thing that, I think becomes the important piece is that if you're a commercial payer and you're in an SIU or payment integrity, your plan was likely touched on this, particularly if you're a larger payer. And there's a huge coordination that has to take effect, particularly with 324 defendants. And we've seen instances where there have been multiple defendants, multiple companies, all in the same geographic or even national, if you're a national payer. The challenge of getting everything into one place, right? So let's talk about what are some of the things that in that SIU space, when you've got some of these larger cases coming in, what should SIUs be thinking of as far as managing a lot, right? You're managing subpoenas, requests for information, people, data, responses to data, evidence collection, all of those.
Right. And I think not to make it about OIG, because I want to talk about SIU work, but I think it's important to kind of lay out a little bit of groundwork that maybe people aren't aware of. And that is that as there's a couple different federal agencies that you would be dealing with, hopefully through the SIU, but take OIG, for example, our mission was to protect the Medicare Trust Fund. So the OIG investigations didn't necessarily focus on commercial, losses at all. That it could involve SIUs, wherein like Advise works as the SIU for certain Medicaid plans. In California, we didn't have that. It was the Bureau of Medi-Cal Fraud or the MFUCU, but it's not in the case agent's mindset to worry about keeping a commercial plan up to speed on what's going on in their investigation, especially a big case like this. So that's where we've talked about this in the past, but that's where a law enforcement liaison or a similar type position, it doesn't have to be specific to that, but to have somebody who's on the SIU team that is routinely in contact with agents, FBI agents, OIG agents, MFUCU agents. So when something like this happens or is brought to light, it's public, the SIU is not looking for, how are we going to make connections to find out what's going on and find out what our exposure is. If you have somebody who regularly meets with people from, the federal agencies, a lot of times they'll have huge meetings with all the agencies that work healthcare fraud. They'll invite commercial plans to come for parts of the meeting. Parts of it they're excluded from because it's law enforcement sensitive. Right. But to have somebody on the SIU who has involvement in those meetings, or at least has points of contacts, or like is a bridge from the SIU to the federal agency. So when something like this happens, they can meet, they can find out whatever is available, certain things they can't share, but when it becomes public, it's important to have somebody from the SIU liaison type person who can reach out to the agents or the ASACs, whoever that are working this case, and really kind of compare notes and see what the exposure could be for the SIU. If there's hundreds of doctors or providers of some type who are charged in a big takedown like this, the odds of them touching the commercial or the SIU plan are pretty good. So you have to have that previous relationship, ongoing relationship, to be able to kind of compare notes and see where you're being hit.
And in that same vein, I think one of the things that's important is that you may not need somebody as a full-time law enforcement liaison. You can have a fractional person or someone that you designate, but certainly on something as large as this, where you may have gotten, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 subpoenas, requests for information, you've got to produce data, you've got a whole bunch of things. And that may be the time that you spin someone up to kind of coordinate that, right? Because it's not necessarily going to be 40 hours a week, every day, all day, but there's certainly going to be a need for that. And it's definitely, you're definitely in a better place if you've got one person as that point of contact to filter it out, you know, that somebody is sitting at that payer and they're tracking all of the subpoenas that have come in, you know, the data subpoena, the provider that's in question, the request, the date it's returned, maybe even if it's assigned to someone, who that person is that's assigned. So you have one point of contact to be the ringleader, you know, for that. And the other thing too is, so you brought up, you know, obviously MedCal and Mifugu. One of the things that was pretty interesting is that one of the fraud schemes in this particular takedown involved high dollar prescriptions that were reimbursed by MedCal, right, which is the Medicaid for California. And they have a prior authorization portal, and certain high dollar prescriptions require prior authorization. Now, as we all know, there is now a big push going on potentially to get rid of prior authorizations. We heard recently the new CMS administrator, Mehmet Oz, is pitching this, that that, you know, getting rid of prior authorizations will reduce administrative burden and things of that sort. But notwithstanding that, prior authorizations still exist. And MedCal had a system where there was a portal for providers to go and get prior authorization approved through whatever the pharmacy for MedCal. Well, there was a period of time where that system was being shut down. It was either being upgraded. There was something going on. I don't quite understand from the press release what exactly the backstory was, but there was a period of time when the prior authorization portal was either not operational or there was a suspension in prior authorization, and it was publicly known. So what did the bad guys do? Boom, 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 boom. Immediately started to hit the fact that that prior authorization didn't exist anymore. And so, you know, a bunch of money was paid out for prescriptions that didn't exist, that weren't filled. People didn't need them. People didn't want them, all because the state didn't do anything to have a backup plan in place for that. So, you know, oftentimes, you know, I always say the road to hell is paved with good intention, right? MedCal was trying to do something to upgrade their system to either be more efficient, whatever it may be, it doesn't really matter. And obviously, when you have something like that happen, you have to provide notification, because if you have a patient that needs potentially a high dollar drug, you've got to provide that notification. And so, you know, the bad guys are going to find ways to capitalize on things. Now, that may not be something that directly affects an SIU, but if you are an SIU for a Medicaid plan in your state, it's going to affect you. So one of the things from the SIU perspective is you've got to keep abreast of what is going on in the state. Right. There are things we know. There are things that Medicaid pays for that Medicare does not pay for. Transportation services are a great example. Right. Attendant care services in the home care services are oftentimes not reimbursable by Medicare, but are reimbursable by Medicaid. But also understanding if there's a prior authorization, what does that mean? How does that work? You know, I think one of the biggest arguments in prior authorization is that on the provider side, when a provider submits a claim in support of a service item or procedure that was done through prior authorization, and the provider gets denied the claim, the provider's going to say, "I had prior authorization. Why are you denying this?" The payer is going to say, "Oh, prior authorization is not a guarantee of payment. It's a promise that if you submit that claim commensurate with policy, that it's a covered item, service, or procedure," right? So prior authorization just says that if you meet other requirements or whatever it may be, this item, service, or procedure could be payable. It's not a promise of payment. But I think, you know, on the SIU perspective, you got to know. And if Medcal is changing something, is that the time that your data analytics team becomes more vigilant on, what drugs require prior authorization? Like, this is a simple one to me. What drugs require prior authorization? Medcal is shutting down its PA system for a period of time. When claims come in that are drugs that require prior authorization, shouldn't we be flagging those drugs and holding them for payment based upon the fact that these normally would have prior authorization? But because we don't have prior authorization in place, what are we doing as the backstop? I mean, there are things that we can be doing that are real time or near real time to kind of fix these. And so, doing that dance, and seeing it, when I saw that, I was a little taken aback by that, because obviously it means the bad guys are up on things as good or better than the payers and law enforcement. And so, being able to articulate that becomes the challenge. But Wade, the other point you brought up, which is really important, is that, having that single point of contact becomes really invaluable. You can't, as a law enforcement person, you don't want to have to deal with 7 or 8 different people within the same organization. You want to have, you want to have one throat to choke. Right. You have one person to go to get the answers that you need and not have to deal with 6 or 7 or 8 different people if you've got potentially exposure through those 6, 7, or 8 people. The other thing, Wade, and then I want to go to Matt, is when you start to learn that these cases are there, you should be opening up parallel cases also and calculating your potential loss amounts, because at the end of the day, the payer is a victim.
Right. And I think it's also important, just to step back a little bit, to have that the liaison person having had experience in the other system, basically. Like, not saying it has to be a retired agent, but the experience that we have had in working those cases and working big takedowns and things of that nature, I think is invaluable, as opposed to just bringing somebody on who doesn't have that experience. So I think having that really, really kind of helps that. And now I forgot what your question was.
That's exactly it. And so, Matt, when I watched the press conference, and I've read all the press releases, and DOJ has put out a million different infographics, you get lost in the sauce on all of them. The 7 defendants and the skin grafts just did not sit well with me for a number of reasons, outside of the potential patient harm issue and honestly, like, the medical necessity part of it. And the fact that clearly these patients were all contained within, we're not talking about one patient in this nursing home, one patient in another. We're talking about concentrated numbers, and the data is there. The data tells you this. And this is almost like, a common beneficiary report. I mean, how many people in one nursing home from one provider? We're talking about 7 providers. So we're not talking about 100 providers around the country. We're talking about 7. And allografts and skin grafts being done in a nursing or in a hospice setting, that kind of raises a flag. Like, why aren't we catching this? It's a little bit like, how did $8 catheters become $2 billion from a wig manufacturer, right? I mean, these kind of things, they just kind of boggle the mind. But an important piece of this puzzle is the fact that we don't really think in terms of the role that UPIX play in this, and particularly when we're talking about Medicare cases and Medicaid cases, the drop everything and work on this immediately, because there's going to be a takedown, and everybody within the organization, and you know it, there's not a secret. When you were at the UPIC, you knew, hey, we're planning a national takedown in June of 2025, and you know about this in the fall of 2024. And that coordination and being able to do that dance, and the realignment of resources, right, is immense. And the fact that you've got 5 UPICs around the country, you've got the medic, and the fact that everybody is on a shared case management system. Like, that dance is even more complicated than the dance that an SIU has to do.
Yes, it is. And just a couple of things. One is, let's remember, this was 2 years in the making. This wasn't something that happened over a month's time. This is 2 years where they're developing these cases. And I'll talk about the UPIC SIU role in all of that. But I will want to quote Tony Curtis from Operation Petticoat, profit out of chaos. That's what these guys do, right? The authorizations go away for an hour, boom. CMS waives the criteria for DME companies to enter the program during COVID. 4,000 new DME companies in Broward County appear in a month's time. They profit out of chaos. But yeah, the SIUs play like a three-pronged role in these types of operations. One is, on a daily basis, we receive requests for information from law enforcement, OIG, DOJ, U.S. Attorney's offices, MFUCUs, and we had people specially designated to be those points of contact on a daily basis. So every law enforcement person knew to go to X to get these things. We had one data analyst and one investigator, depending on what type of information they needed. And that was on a daily basis. So when something like this hits and we start getting more and more of those and we start getting subpoenas, we knew how to handle them and we tracked them and we knew what was going on. And we had at least quarterly formal meetings with OIG, and they would also involve other agencies when the IG would invite them, including U.S. Attorney's offices, FBI, other, and they would talk about, in general, these takedowns and what the timing was and what we could expect in terms of the information needs. And we would be able to prepare for those things. The other way was during, we referred cases to the OIG on a routine basis. Many of them became these cases that were then part of the takedown. So we provided the information that allowed them to open cases. And that was, again, months and years in the making. The other is, and this is where CMS plays a role as well, especially with 5 UPICs. They talked about, $10 billion being saved through suspensions. Those are the actions that CMS takes using the UPICs to implement those suspensions on those providers. And those are resource intensive. And if they're talking, $10 billion of money being saved, that's probably dozens, if not hundreds, of providers that are being suspended across the country. And many of these are national in scope. So it's coordination among the UPICs as to who is the lead UPIC on this, who is supporting it and coordinating all of the information there. So it was a lot of coordination, I'm sure, for this one, because this was the latest of a dozen or so of these types of takedowns that have occurred in the past 10 years, and each one of them brought this type of activity together, the coordination amongst all the role players, including the MACs, the administrative contractors, who we coordinated cases with on a routine basis, but also, would tell them, you can't take action on this person. It's part of a da-da-da-da-da. And, it's like a do not, what was it? The zone restrictions that were put on. All of those played into building up to these types of things. And it would take a lot of resources, but we were able to do it because we had just the routine in place based on our coordinated activity with the law enforcement on a routine basis. We knew how to do it. SIUs, it's a little different story. They've got to be able to maybe create more of a relationship with law enforcement through a liaison or whoever to start figuring out what do we need to do to make these things possible. And so it's not going to come as a shock and then chaos, and then someone's profiting from that chaos because maybe you don't get the right information to them. It's too late in coming. The resources taken away has made you vulnerable in other areas. So there's a steamroll effect there. So having a plan in place beforehand is very important to coordinating when these large events take place.
Right. So just for a minute on the data. So, you know, Dr. Oz, when in that press conference, he talked about how they were creating a healthcare data. They're calling it the Fusion Center. I am going to guess that it's going to be similar to what's known as the PRAC, the Pandemic Response Accountability, where they're amalgamating data. You know, the PRAC is taking in data from, like, you know, HHS. It's taking in from SBA, IRS, right? Because we did see in some of the roundups, some of the people that were charged with PPP fraud, payment protection, a lot of COVID, right? So people are now, we're starting to see a little bit more of the results from COVID-19 related prosecutions, over-the-counter services, over-the-counter tests being billed and the medical necessity of that. But, you know, one of the cases that they specifically talked about was a provider who they used the term teleporting, right? Because it was a nurse practitioner in Florida, and she was billing for services in Albany, New York, I think, or something like that. But, you know, these instances where the person is in one state, they're billing for services in another, it's not billed as a telemed service because they're not using the right modifier or whatever. But, you know, on some of these, when you read the underlying facts, and again, we're only going on public information. We may or may not have had inside information about any of this, but we're talking about what's in the public record that everybody else is seeing. You read these facts that are out in the public domain, and of course, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, why didn't they shut down these million numbers immediately? Why was it that the breach occurred in May, but it wasn't until July that CMS was notified? And why was it that it wasn't until October that the new issued MBIs were given? So you have the end of May, you've got June, July, August, September, 5 months of those MBIs being out there before they were turned. Now, one thing that I haven't done, I haven't looked at the time period for all of the fraud to see how much of it overlapped, but there's certainly going to be periods of time where there was overlap on that. A lot of these cases are 2020 to 2024, so there's going to be some of that that's in there. But from that data perspective, are we in this space, are we just not mature enough in our analytic ability to be able to do some of the things that we Monday morning quarterback? Because we Monday morning quarterback here all the time because that's what we have to do. And it's like, well, why did this happen, right? We look at the $2 billion catheter case and we say, how is it that nobody was able to see that a wig shop that had billed $50,000 to Medicaid 1 year is now billing out millions of dollars for catheters another year? Why are we not able to catch that? Why are we not able to catch the instances of skin grafts of from seven providers for people that are at end of life hospice? Why isn't anybody saying, wait a minute, why are we not catching the DME where the person has a bilateral amputation above the knee and they're getting two knee braces, right? Are we going back to last week's conversation? Are we so lost in the sauce that we are ignoring the importance of diagnosis codes? Are we just not mature enough is the technology not mature enough? Is it we don't have enough people to look at this data? Is it, I don't know what the answer is, but the fact that we're seeing fraud schemes that we have seen for 30 years, for Matt, maybe a little bit longer, but that we're seeing for years. And again, the circus hasn't changed. It's just different clowns.
My first case was a DME case, the same type of thing. You know, it's
yeah, crazy. But when you were a working case agent, DME was two 2x4s and some rope, and then it was a splint. That was a brace was, you know.
It was a wheel. That's all they had invented by that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I get it. So what's the, and you know.
You look at, you know, that case with the Albany and Florida person, the teleporter. It might be that that's in two different places, the data. Look at it by two different people. They don't see that they're billing in two different places because it's a different MAC in New York than it is in Florida. It's a different Medicaid unit in New York than it is in Florida. Maybe they're not seeing the whole picture, which brings up this Fusion Center. If the Fusion Center is what I hope it is bringing all of that data Medicare, Medicaid, VA, OPM, DOD, any other government benefit program, healthcare program, putting it in one place, and then they'll be able to see the whole picture. And then, you know, God forbid,
right,
commercial comes in as well and provides their data. So they actually get a fusion of data, and it's not just more lines being put into the small pools that still don't see the big picture.
You know, well, I think, what? Go ahead, Wade.
I think part of the problem with that, too, is going to be that what we used to see is when we're trying to combine data from, like you said, VA or DCIS data or something like that, the data fields, you can't, it's not a matter of just combining it all into one huge access database.
The fields are
different. You have to compare.
It took CMS how many years to normalize the Medicaid?
Right. So that's a great example, right? So when we talk about the normalization of data, what we're talking about is the disparity in the fields. In the Medicare space, column A might be last name, comma, first name. In the Medicaid space from New York, column A might be last name, column B might be first name. And what they call the normalization of, three types of data: structured, semi-structured, and unstructured. Structured data is each field is very well defined. Last name in a column, first name in a column. Semi-structured data might be last name, comma, first name in the same column. And unstructured data is just data that's in one line, kind of like a text string that we see it. And one of the biggest challenges is that in order to be able to do those analyses, that data has to be the same. The Medicaid data has to be the same across the Medicaid lines, Medicare, and so on. Several years ago, CMS undertook a project to what they entitled the transformative of what's known as MSIS data, which is Medicaid systems data. And the T was transformative to make it all aligned with each other so that it was consistent. And that's a huge challenge. I'm hoping that what the Fusion Center will do something along those lines across those government payers, and hopefully we'll see that will actually have some ability to reduce. I mean, right now we've got the UPICS run data. CMS has a data platform called FPS, Fraud Prevention System, which apparently is supposed to work very well. Within the OIG, there's a division that's known as the DDA, which is the Department or Division of Data Analytics, and that is run by a team of data scientists who ingest data. Agents can run dashboards, things of that. You've got through CMS something called 1PI, which is the central data repository that takes data from what they call the IDR, which is used to be known as the Common Working File. It's now the IDR. OIG agents have access to 1PI and can run some basic queries there. You know, Medicaid plans have data. The Medicaid payers, there's more. This is, you know, for those of you that know the phrase Rube Goldberg, how to build a better mousetrap. There are so many data analytics companies out there. If you've ever been to NAMPI or you've ever been to NHCAA, it is very heavy vendor, focused in the data space. And every vendor has their own nuance to how they do that data and what their dashboards look like and all of that. So I'm hoping that this Data Fusion Center, and I'm hoping to learn a little bit more about it, will actually have an effect on the ability of the programs to police things a little bit better, to stop and verify, right? To use the phrase that's out there is this premise of stop and verify, stop that money before it goes out. Now, my understanding is that of the $14.6 billion that was identified, most of that money did not go out. I think in particular for the $10 or $11 million case with the overseas, only about $42 million of the $11 billion went out. Now, some would say, hey, that's great. You stopped less than, I think, you know, like 1% would be $100 million or something like that. So you stopped less than 1%, you know, one half of 1%, you stopped, but $42 million lost is still $42 million that's not gained, right? The programs are bleeding money. And so that $42 million is a big number, even though it is only one half of 1% of the money that was attached to this fraud scheme. So there's going to be a lot that comes out of this. You've got 300 24 defendants. We're seeing individual press releases coming out from the different districts where these cases were being adjudicated. So we're going to see a lot more. I will tell you that I think that 324 defendants all pleading guilty. And by the way, it was 324 charged. Some of them were civil. So there aren't 324 criminal defendants. There were some civil cases. There are going to be trials. Not everybody is going to plead guilty. Some of these are people that are out of the country. So they're going to be put onto the OIG's fugitive website. You know, there's going to be a lot of that that's outstanding. And we'll kind of see where a lot of that winds up going, because 324 charged individuals, they're not all criminal. Some of them may have been charged criminally. They'll maybe plead to something that's a little bit lesser on the indictment. Maybe some of these will result in what they call global resolutions, where maybe there's a large dollar amount criminally and they'll bifurcate it into a criminal civil and they'll offset some of that money criminally to civil. The strike force was heavily involved. We'll see where a lot of those cases go, but there are going to be trials and we'll have to see where kind of all of this, you know, ends up. But this is probably just the beginning. For a lot of these cases, it's the end. Cases that have been resolved civilly, cases in which people have pleaded guilty to an information, those cases are obviously going to be resolved. There weren't a lot of those, but those that have been charged by criminal complaint, those that have been charged by indictment, we'll see where those go. But we'll probably be hearing about resolutions on these cases for some time to come. And for those that were in districts in which multiple defendants were charged, there is the prospect that multiple defendants will look to go to trial. And you're talking about back-to-back trials. Which if you've ever had, I had one case where I had three trials in 14 months and each trial was supposed to only be a couple of weeks and each one went for 6 or 8 weeks. And if you weren't on trial, you were preparing for trial. And so I wish those that are going to end up in multiple trials good luck, particularly in multi-defendant cases in which the court grants a separation and you've got multiple trials going on back to back. It's not really a fun time. So I wish people luck on that. And, you know, we'll keep track. You know, we're curious about how these are all going to turn out. I'm sure the LinkedIn community will continue to pontificate on things. I love reading some of the defense lawyers who do healthcare. I love reading opinions and thoughts on that. It's great. Some of the legal opinions are great, and the legal thoughts and some of the legal thoughts on the intersection, particularly in the opioid space in the post-Ruan world, where, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office has to definitively demonstrate that the prescription that was written in an unauthorized manner, which presents its own set of challenges when providers have plenary licenses and can write prescriptions for a lot of things. It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. It'll be interesting to see spinoff cases, because there are going to be spinoff cases, particularly in the telemed. That is an area that is just the tons of fraud, fraught with fraud. So we'll see where that goes. I think, you know, we'll continue to see how these cases refine themselves, and how the data analytics continues to get better. And hopefully there'll be some better instances in the stop and verify space versus the pay and chase world that we currently live in. So good stuff. Thanks very much for sticking around. I know we went over a little bit normally from our normal, you know, 20 or 25 minutes. This is an important one. Largest one in history, and we'll see where it goes. You know, as everybody knows in the government, you always want to do better than you did last time. So these don't go away. These roundups average once or twice a year. And selfishly, I did like the fact that when the representative from the criminal division got up, the first agency that they talked about was HHS-OIG and the importance of HHS-OIG in the fraud, waste, and abuse investigative space. The acting IG getting up and talking about, obviously, the great work that the Office of Investigations does. And, you know, Wade and Matt, that was our home for a long time. And so we're a little bit particular to it, good, bad, or indifferent, you know, when we were at the end of our career or how we think things might be now. But it was good to see that they mentioned HHS-OIG first. And how, you know, we were known, you know, we were kind of the HHS-OIG was the lead agency. And so I will say kudos to the people over at the Office of Investigations, and obviously the leadership of the Deputy Inspector General for Investigations over there, Chris Schrank. I'll give him a special call out, only because I mentored him, and he's like my, but you know, I have to give kudos to my kids. Like, what can I tell you? I give kudos to my kids. I thought it was great. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what kind of transpires in this. Will providers look to change their patterns and practices? Those that are committing fraud, probably not, because the fraudsters don't care about what press releases come out or anything like that. So, we'll continue to see where these cases go and where the spinoffs go. And hopefully in the SIU space, I'm hoping that a lot of the SIU people are taking a look at what these cases resulted in overpayments to the, to your plans, and look to tighten up some of the policies out there that you might have.
Can we provide a link to the DOJ press releases on our website so that SIUs can go there and see the list of defendants and maybe check their billings to see if they've been impacted?
Yeah. We'll have this link. We'll have this link with our LinkedIn and in the newsletter. We'll attach the two. There are two main links. One is the link with the big press release, and one is the links to the individual defendants by district, with names and businesses and all that. So yeah, we'll include both of those in the LinkedIn deployment, which will be out, and our newsletter for this week. Yeah, great idea. We'll do that. And again, as always, we thank everybody for tuning in and spending the time and learning from us. We learn from you, from the questions you ask. And we hope to see you all on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.